Now, shall we begin?
Angie's death definitely shattered our family. No one can ever possibly imagine, when you go through something like this, of the damage, of how deeply it is. You know, it's horrible. I told many officers, you know what? This isn't directed at you. All I want to know is why my daughter was killed and who killed her. And I think I may never know the why. Hopefully someday I'll know the who.
There are many occasions when exasperated citizens are tempted to exclaim, you had one job, government, and that is to protect us against lethal criminal violence. Or at least, in any case, that's what we were taught in the local government-licensed mind laundry. Historian R.J. Rummel, with whom some of you are probably familiar, pioneered the study of democide, which is the mass killing of citizens by governments that were supposedly established to protect them. And he puts the proposition in somewhat more elevated language, noting that the common and fundamental justification for government is that it exists to protect citizens against the anarchic jungle that would otherwise threaten their lives and property. The inescapable reality of the situation, Rummel reminds us, is that in the modern era, especially, government has been truly a cold-blooded mass murderer, a global plague of man's own making. Centuries ago, St. Augustine warned that political governments are simply criminal bands that have defeated all their available rivals, imposed their will through violence, and then given themselves legal impunity. As he put it in The City of God, they are distinguished from criminal bands of a conventional type, not by virtue, but by the attainment of impunity. In his indispensable work, Our Enemy the State, Albert J. Nock refined that diagnostic insight somewhat by pointing out that the government never seeks to abolish crime in the conventional sense, but rather to assert a monopoly on crime, where appropriate, perhaps granting limited territorial franchises to collaborators in the private criminal underworld. This is particularly true, by the way, where prohibition exists, either prohibition of alcohol or prohibition of narcotics. The government doesn't seek to abolish the provision of vice and the consumption thereof. It wants to syndicate vice in ways that make it profitable to politically connected concerns. When agents of this evil fiction calling itself the state aren't killing or otherwise brutalizing the innocent directly and are supposedly doing battle with unlicensed private sector criminals, they carry out the task of investigating crimes against the innocent with all of the competence and efficiency we have come to expect from government in any realm. Accepting the self-serving official statistics at face value, 40% of reported homicides remain unsolved. Last year, for example, the Chicago Police Department, which imposes itself upon a city with the country's strictest gun laws and therefore the country's largest problem of gun-related violence, solved just 26% of the city's 472 homicides. It has to be understood as well that when a police department claims to have solved or closed a case, they don't necessarily mean that the perpetrator has been convicted, assuming, of course, that they found the correct perpetrator. This generally means that a suspect has either been arrested or killed. When a suspect is killed, that's called an extraordinary clearance of a crime. And for some departments, saying that these crimes have been cleared might mean that the perpetrator remains at large, but they've just given up. When a violent crime is committed, the victim doesn't have the option of choosing the most competent police agency, assuming that one exists, to investigate the crime. He or she must be content with the service, such as it is, offered by the department claiming a local franchise within the government's coercion cartel. And because it operates as part of a monopoly, the police department can't go out of business, and therefore it treats customer dissatisfaction as an officer safety issue rather than a reason to improve its job performance. All of this helps explain why, in a country where the government confiscates billions of dollars each year in the name of public safety, citizens probably spend at least that much, or perhaps even more, to pay for protection of persons and property. I would estimate that citizens who seek to hire private investigators or private security firms, or otherwise seek to avail themselves of the private security market, that the aggregate expenditures on private security would be comparable to, if not greater than, the amount that is taxed directly in order to pay for police agencies. All of these services are supposedly provided through the state's security monopoly. So we are taxed in order to create and sustain this apparatus of coercion, and because it doesn't carry out its advertised function, if we are looking for actual protection of persons and property, or if we are seeking the services of somebody who will actually carry out a competent investigation of a crime committed against the same, we have to pay for it ourselves, sometimes in kind. In the case of Idaho Falls resident Carol Dodge, the failure of the Idaho Falls Police Department to find the perpetrator who murdered her daughter Angie in June of 1996 meant that she had to do the job herself.
They did everything in their power to make me go away. Every time I ever went in there, Jared Herman would be sitting at his desk with a suit on, and he would just be this perfect image, if not a hair out of place. And I'd say, Jared, so what's new? You know, because I was out every night on the street, you know. Well, nothing's new, Carol. And I go, well, you just sit there because I'm going out on the street again tonight, and I'll come and report to you tomorrow. And so I would actually go to the police department every day, and I kept him really busy.
The Jared to whom Carol Dodge referred, obviously, is former Idaho Falls Police Detective Jared Furman, who went on to become mayor of Idaho Falls, after he supposedly solved the case of the Angie Dodge murder by framing a perfectly innocent young man by the name of Chris Tapp. In the fashion of government police agencies nationwide, when confronted with a case that is difficult to solve, rather than applying intelligence and discipline to try to determine what had happened to the victim, Jared Furman and his comrades at the IFPD simply rounded up three young men who had nothing to do with that horrible crime, and set them off against each other in an effort to get one or more of them to break and accuse at least one of them of the crime. They didn't want to solve the crime by finding the correct perpetrator. What they wanted to do was clear the case by finding somebody they could send to prison.
Ben Hobbs and Chris Tapp ran together, and so when Ben Hobbs got arrested over in Ely, Nevada, they said, okay, who ran with Ben Hobbs? They called them both in, and they had him down there at the police department, and they were telling Jeremy that Chris was turning on him, and they were telling Chris that Jeremy and Ben were turning on him. And Chris was the one that just took the sinker in the line and the hook and said, oh, really?
The Jeremy to whom Carol Dodge referred was a young man by the name of Jeremy Sargis. His family had a great deal of wealth and influence in Bonneville County. For that reason, he was able to find competent legal representation who advised him to say nothing to the police. Sargis invoked the Fifth Amendment, as was his right, which is what Chris Tapp should have done. Ben Hobbs had been arrested in Ely, Nevada, on an unrelated rape charge for which he served a lengthy prison sentence. Not having the competence to conduct an actual murder investigation, Jared Furman and his comrades attempted to get Jeremy Sargis and Chris Tapp to implicate Ben Hobbs. For the aforementioned reasons, Jeremy Sargis was able to defeat that strategy simply by keeping his mouth shut. At one point in an interrogation session with Jared Furman, Sargis rebuked the detective for being foolish, which precipitated a meltdown on the part of Jared Furman. He stormed angrily from the room because he realized that he was not going to be able to bully or browbeat Sargis into cooperating in his scheme. Chris Tapp, on the other hand, was an ingenuous young man who fell prey to the mental molestation practiced by Jared Furman and Detective Steve Finn. After being threatened with the death penalty unless he provided them with an allegation against Ben or Jeremy, Chris Tapp recited back to them what he was being fed by the detectives. When his friends were eliminated as suspects, the detectives focused their energies on him, extracting from him a testimony that now even the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office must admit was false and useless. And yet he was convicted on the basis of that false confession. And to this day, Jared Furman does not have the dangling anatomy to admit to Carol Dodge what he did.
I ran into Jared Furman a couple of months ago. Him and his wife and a group of people were at McDonald's. Jared was standing at the counter, and you know, even though they say he has memory loss, he totally recognized me, and he looked straight at me, and he says, Carol, I want you to know one thing. That little son of a bitch was there, and I don't care what anybody said. Really, for a half hour, I tried to convince my friend Knight that he had done the right thing, that Chris was there, and don't let anybody try and tell you any different. Chris was there, Carol, and we've got the right person. Now we just need to get Ben Hobbs.
I will have a great deal more to say about this when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom Zealot Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Stand by for more Sedition after this. Christopher Tapp has spent nearly half his life in prison for a horrible crime he did not commit. On September 29th, he did win a partial victory. As a matter of fact, this is his first legal victory since he was abducted by Jared Furman and Furman's comrades in January of 1997. District Judge Alan Stevens issued a ruling that there is a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the polygraph examination tapes were produced to Chris Tapp and his defense attorney prior to the trial, that's the trial for May of 1998, and whether the petitioner's claim is barred by the statute of limitations. Therefore, the defendant's motion for summary dismissal, the defendant in this case being the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office, must be denied. The prosecution knowingly withheld at least three critical videotaped interrogation sessions in which Detective Stephen Finn used false polygraph findings to manipulate Chris Tapp into a false confession after Finn, conspiring, no other word is suitable, with Jared Furman, threatened Chris Tapp with death unless he cooperated, first by offering false testimony against his friends Ben Hobbs and Jeremy Sarges, and then as a way of saving his life by getting him to admit to being in the room when the rape and murder of Angie Dodge took place in June of 1996, and then taking a knife and stabbing her in the breast. Chris Tapp's confession does not match the forensic evidence of the wounds to the victim. His description of what she was wearing does not match the recorded facts of the case. He could not describe the layout of the crime scene. He originally said that he thought that the crime took place downstairs when it took place in her upstairs bedroom, which is a room he had never seen and could not accurately describe, until he had been taken there during the investigation by Jared Furman and Furman's comrades. He is in prison because of the criminal actions of Jared Furman, Stephen Finn, several of their comrades at the IFPD, and the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office. At least three critical tapes were not provided to the defense prior to the trial in 1998. This is what is known as a Brady violation. Two of the tapes were provided to Chris Tapp's appellate attorney no more recently than a year ago. One of them was destroyed. The Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office said that it was the fault of the defense that they did not file an appeal on the basis of evidence that had been systematically withheld from them by the prosecution. Jared Furman, a liar and a coward, has committed grotesque crimes against Chris Tapp and against the administration of justice. If he had been a private investigator, he would be personally liable for what he did. As somebody who exercised the supposed authority of the government's law enforcement apparatus, he enjoys qualified immunity and two taxpayer-funded pensions, one from his time at the IFPD and the second from his time as the mayor of Idaho Falls, which is an office to which he was elected on the strength of his law enforcement career. Several months ago, I interviewed Dan Landis, who is the president of the Private Investigators Association of Idaho. Idaho does not require private investigators to be licensed. There are six cities in the state of Idaho. Boise, interestingly, is not one of them that require private investigators to be licensed. And Dan Landis wants to create a certified private investigator program that would establish professional standards for that industry. The first requirement to become a certified private investigator, if Landis's program is adopted, would be to carry and maintain at least $500,000 in what is described as errors and omissions or general liability insurance. Here is his explanation for why this would be valuable. Anybody looking to hire a reputable and reliable investigator should require him to have at least $500,000 in liability insurance if someone gets hurt through an act or an oversight or gets arrested for the wrong reason. The investigator needs to be covered, because a private investigator, unlike a police detective, will be held individually accountable if he accuses somebody falsely of a crime and a legal proceeding results from that false accusation. Landis's group, the Private Investigators Association of Idaho, has minimum standards for certification that are much more demanding than those that must be met for police applicants in many municipalities, both in Idaho and elsewhere. Applicants cannot have a criminal record of any kind. In most municipalities, you can become a police officer if you have not been convicted of a felony. The PIAI would require that all private investigators be bonded and pass a deep and extensive background check. There is no private investigators academy, but applicants would be required to have a minimum of 500 hours verifiable experience in the field of private investigations. Significantly, according to their list of criteria, and I quote, "Law enforcement, government, or military experience does not qualify as private investigations. Being ex-law enforcement doesn't mean a thing," Landis told me, "because a police officer, in the final analysis," he said, "is merely an individual with a gun, a badge, and a suit." And as he explained to me, police officers close cases not through investigation, not through logic and reasoning and deduction, by assembling the facts and making a compelling logical case to identify an individual as a criminal suspect, but through threats, coercion, manipulation, and perjury. Once again, one of the most important benefits of seeking out private assistance in the security field is that if somebody doesn't perform up to expectations, you can fire the person who acts as a private investigator or a private security operative. As the career of Jared Furman and his comrades so eloquently attests, there is no incentive to get the case right the first time, but every incentive to cling with desperate tenacity to a falsehood that has been ratified by the courts. I will be back in just a moment. Whatever happened to Jeremy Sargis?
Jeremy Sargis is up in Coeur d'Alene for the first time in 20 years. Jeremy and I now have a really good relationship, and his life was ruined. His life literally got ruined. I mean, he could have inherited a multi-million-dollar company from his father, and life was so hard for Jeremy here because of Angie's case. He ended up moving to Coeur d'Alene just to get out of it. And, you know, it took that family a long time to recover from that. I mean, a long, long time. And, in fact, it's just a year ago that I walked up to his father and said, "Oh, EJ, I am so, so sorry for what happened." I said, "I did not know." I said, "I believed everything IFPD told me, and I am so sorry." And he just looked at me and he said, "I accept your apology." allergy, and we just both cried and hugged. He says, Carol, I can't even tell you what they did to all of us. And yet, to look at them, they didn't do anything. They still think that Jeremy, because he took the Fifth Amendment, that he's holding back information. They still believe that. IFPD still believes that, because IFPD says Jeremy may have not have been there, but he has knowledge of who was. Mormon intuition.
Dear Lanny, I know you might not remember who I am. I am your ex-sister-in-law. My maiden name was Julie Burke, and I was married to your brother in 1984. We were divorced in January of 1986, wrote Idaho Falls resident Judy Waddell to Lanny Smith, who, like Chris Tapp, has been in prison for decades for murders he did not commit. In this case, the murders were most likely committed by Lanny Smith's adopted brother, Jeffrey Lynn Smith, who is likewise a very good candidate for the identity of the true murderer of Angie Dodge. Before that time, your brother basically terrorized me, wrote Judy Waddell, referring to the divorce of January 1986. He threatened my life, tried to kill me several times, and in 1986 I was really in fear for my life from him. That same year, in the spring or summer, I remember hearing the sound of your vehicle pull up in front of my house on Halsey in Idaho Falls, Idaho. I looked out the window and saw you running up to my door with your brother Jeff right behind you. I saw you stand in front of my door when Jeff caught you, pushed you in front of my window, and began beating you viciously. I need to point out that Lanny Smith is developmentally delayed. As a very young child, probably about 2 years of age, he was hit by a car and nearly killed, and as a result suffered a traumatic brain injury that left him very childlike in many respects. People refer to him as slow. Some people have used the term retarded. He is capable of maintaining a job. He had worked at a local golf course. And as this letter from his ex-sister-in-law attests, he was not the sort of a person who had a disposition toward violence. As a matter of fact, if anything, he was very protective of people. I don't remember what happened after that, continued Julie Waddell, but I will always remember the fact that you tried your best to keep me from being hurt by your brother, all at the cost of being assaulted yourself. I have always been touched by the fact that you were willing to do this, even though you didn't know who I was. That's how I know that you were not the least bit capable of the crimes you have been charged with by the state. I do not believe that anyone who would take the kind of beating that you sustained on my behalf would be the kind of monster who would murder those two elderly people in cold blood. The people to whom she is referring are Leo and Mary Donnard, who are next-door neighbors to the Smith family, who were murdered in March of 1992. I do believe that your brother Jeff would have done this crime and then turned around to let you take the blame for it, continued Jeff's first of two ex-wives. I have evidence that Jeff Smith confessed to other violent crimes. I also have recent evidence that points to someone trying to invoke Jeff in stalking and harming me just a few years ago. To me, that shows that your brother is capable of doing violence of a kind that would have taken the lives of the Donnards. The detective, Victor Rodriguez, formerly of the Bonneville County Sheriff's Office, later of the Nampa Police Department, and now retired, the detective who investigated your case has been shown to have faked evidence and lied on record in other cases, continues Julie Woodell, who, by the way, was not permitted to testify at Lanny Smith's trial. How do we know that didn't happen with you? I know that the police were given evidence by me about what kind of violence Jeff was capable of towards me, but they refused to listen to me. Now two people are dead, and the wrong man is in jail. Is there any way you could call me to discuss what we might be able to do to help you in your case? I have prepaid through PCS to enable you to call me. Please call me as soon as you can. I would like to help you. All of those statements by Julie Woodell were also filed as a sworn affidavit in the ongoing appeal on behalf of Lanny Smith. Robin Jacobson, also known as Robin Smith, also filed an affidavit on behalf of Lanny Smith. She is Jeff's second ex-wife. I was married to Jeff Smith on two separate occasions. The first time I married him was in May of 1988. I met Jeff Smith in March of 1988. I was 32 years old. He was a user. He used alcohol, drugs, and he used people. In 1990, he came to Valley Care, where she worked, and threatened to blow my head off with a .22 if I did not let him take things out of our house. I had locked him out, and he was mad and came to work and confronted me. I called the police. I divorced Jeff Smith the first time in 1991 with the help of Idaho Legal Aid. I divorced him because he would not work. He took all the money I earned. He lied about where he was, and he stayed out late drinking with his friends. He was mentally and physically abusive with me. He used the money I earned to do what he wanted instead of paying household bills. Jeff Smith tried to talk me out of the divorce. He was very unhappy about the divorce and would not leave me alone after the divorce in 1991. After our divorce, I worked 5 days a week for anywhere from 8 to 16 hours per day. In 1992, Jeff Smith was arrested for the crime of the Downard murders. I heard he was accused on the news. It was a horrible time for me because police officers came to my work and home constantly to question me. When Jeff Smith was released from jail during the time he was accused, he came to my work at the Valley Life Care Center with two girls under the age of 18 with him in his truck. He asked me for money. I told him I did not have any money. He told me, quote, "I will put you down like I did the Downards." In other words, he essentially confessed to that murder in the presence of witnesses. During the time that Jeff Smith was accused of murder, Jeff was watching me and following me. He would put notes on my door like, "I would not come home if I were you. I was babysitting the children of my boss and had taken them to the store. When I returned home, there was a note on my door. I had to call my boss and have her pick up the kids. I then called the police, reported the incident, and gave them the note. That's a murder threat from a murder suspect. When I lived on 17th Street, when we were divorced the first time, I was getting ready for work, and Jeff Smith snuck in through the sliding glass window and raped me. He fled. I went into shock and had to go to the hospital in an ambulance. My neighbors found me, and they called for the ambulance." Once again, there are witnesses, and there are records of that offense. On March 25th, 1994, my mother's birthday and my payday, Jeff Smith was on his motorcycle and he told me he would meet me at work. He met me and told me that I had to marry him again. Jeff Smith grabbed me by my arm and threatened me. He told me that if I married him, I would not have to answer any more questions about him and the Downard murders. That's before the trial of Lanny Smith, incidentally. I believed that he would kill me like he had the Downards if I did not marry him. I was afraid to say no to him. He drove me directly to the courthouse that day, and we were married by a judge. My second marriage to him was more horrible than the first. He asked me to have an open marriage so he could sleep with other women. Jeff did not get along with his brother Lanny Smith. Once again, this is an affidavit filed with the court by his second wife. Jeff always asked Lanny for money. Jeff was verbally and physically abusive to Lanny. Jeff is hateful. Jeff wanted what he wanted. Jeff would start arguments and would push the argument until he got his way. Jeff would not take no for an answer from anyone. Lanny Smith took care of his mom, helped his sister, and Lanny did not argue. He would offer me a ride when I was walking. I had to turn him down sometimes because I knew Jeff would get mad if he found out Lanny gave me a ride. Lanny Smith was likable. He had friends. He kept his jobs. He had a good attitude. He didn't borrow money or ask to borrow money. He is the opposite of Jeff Smith. Once again, I think it's significant that Jeff Smith was an adopted child. They obviously, notwithstanding the fact they were brought up in the same home, were two completely different personalities. In 1996, I divorced Jeff again. Among the reasons why she divorced him the second time was that Jeff would take my paycheck and spend it as he wanted instead of paying rent and power bills. He tried to choke me to death. One time he pinned me to the ground and choked me. Another time he put my head through an open sliding glass window and slammed the sliding window down on my neck 3 or 4 times. This is the man who was one of the chief prosecution witnesses against Lanny Smith, summarizes his second wife. I always believed and still believe that Jeff Smith murdered the Downards. I have told this to the police many, many times. I'll be back in just a minute. I am the biological sister of Lanny Smith, wrote Vicky Smith in an affidavit filed on his behalf 5 years ago. I am 40 years old. Obviously, she is now 45 years of age. I have always wanted to testify on Lanny's behalf to assist in his case. I have wanted to do this despite pressure on him from my father not to testify in a manner that would implicate my brother Jeff Smith. I believe Lynn Smith, the father, passed away in 2009, if memory serves. I do not know why the defense attorneys for Lanny did not use me and my testimony in Lanny's trial or at his post-conviction hearing. I do know that Victor Rodriguez, the primary investigating detective in Lanny's case, hounded me to make a statement. Victor Rodriguez told me that Lanny would go down for the Downard murders no matter what anyone said or did. Victor Rodriguez came to my house many times, and in particular, he came when I had just gotten back from the hospital after being in preterm labor. He refused to leave and forced his way into my house. Lanny has always been kind, caring, gentle, and soft-spoken. He would give and do anything for anyone. I remember him as a very sweet little boy. When he was 2 years old, he was hit by a car and almost died. My family has always believed that this was when he became slow in his mental capacity. As he grew up, he mowed my lawn when I had my own household. He would invite me to North's chuck wagon, where he worked, and buy me lunch. He was quiet and shy as an adult, but very kind. He would always come to the defense of others. I remember Lanny coming to Julie Woodall's, a.k.a. Smith, defense, when she was married to Jeff. I never saw Lanny show any kind of anger. He did defend himself on several occasions when Jeff would punch him. Jeff and Lanny did not get along, but I remember most of their arguments being over Lanny coming to the defense of Judy Woodall, a.k.a. Smith, based on something Jeff said or did. Jeff Smith has the opposite personality of Lanny. Jeff is mean, angry, violent, and dangerous. Jeff Smith attempted to rape me when I was 16 years old, asserts his sister, Vicky Smith. One day he told me he needed to talk with me in his room. He had Playboy magazines and other pornography laid out on his bed. He asked me to take off my clothes and pose like the models. I told him no, and he said, why not? I told him I was his sister, this was wrong, and I did not want to. He said because he was adopted, we were not related. There was no question in my mind, because Jeff had been sexually inappropriate with me before, that he was going to rape me. I was able to get out of his room and get away from him. After this incident with Jeff, my grades fell in my school, and one of my school counselors talked to me. I started to trust the counselor, so I told her what Jeff had done to me. The counselor decided to hold a family meeting at my house. My dad, Lynn Smith, was out of town at the time. My grandmother, my mother, and the counselor all came to my house. It was decided that my family would try to keep Jeff away from me. After this, Jeff would use a butter knife to pry apart the door jamb on the door frame and watch me in the shower or in my bedroom dressing. I used to put chains in front of my bedroom door to add an extra layer of security from him breaking in my room while I was there. When I was a teenager, Jeff got mad at one of our neighbors, Ted Bohm. He went downstairs and got a rifle and said he was going to kill Mr. Bohm. I called my grandmother and she came over. She talked Jeff into putting the gun away. Jeff knew how to get into the locked gun cabinet because he knew where the keys were. That's significant, because one of the rifles in the gun cabinet, a .22 caliber rifle, was allegedly used as the murder weapon in the Downard killings. When Lanny was in jail, charged with murder, I would visit him, continues Vicky Smith. An inmate by the name of James Swagger befriended me. He befriended me by flirting with me. I stopped talking to James Swagger when I had an instinct or feeling that James Swagger was trying to use me to help himself and hurt my brother Lanny, and that is precisely what he was trying to do. In September of 2011, which was just a few weeks after this affidavit was filed by Vicky Smith, James Swagger contacted the appellate attorney for Lanny Smith. James Swagger by this time had served a term in prison in Nevada. He was living in Oregon once again. And he wanted to unbosom himself of what had actually happened while he was held in the Minnetonka County Jail in Burley as a roommate of Lanny Smith. They'd been sent there from Idaho Falls because there had been a cap put on the Bonneville County Jail, and because there was a surplus population, some of them had to be sent to nearby Burley, relatively nearby. It's not really that close. As a result of conversations with Vicky Smith, who was visiting her brother, and with Lanny Smith, James Swagger learned the identity of the lead investigator, Victor Martinez, and sent him a letter offering to testify against Lanny in exchange for considerations. I think from my perspective, I was more convinced that his brother had done it, explained James Swagger in September of 2011. I wasn't convinced that Lanny was guilty. I thought Lanny was the fall guy for his brother, and because of Lanny's mental condition, it was played on him. The trial was a joke from what I remembered from it. Those defense attorneys for Lanny really didn't have a chance. It was an open and shut case. It was over and done with. It wasn't thorough. We found somebody. Let's convict him and get it over with. Did Lanny ever tell you that he did anything to the Downards? Swagger was asked, to which he replied, no, he didn't. He never told you anything at all? No. He just told me the story of what they were saying and what they were accusing him of, and basically what evidence they had. I am straight up asking you that your testimony was that he confessed to these things, and you are saying now that he didn't? Asked the attorney. Tell me how you distinguish between the two. Swagger replied, I guess I really didn't. I guess I didn't distinguish. I took what he had told me and kind of turned it as if he was confessing instead of someone who was confiding in me and was scared. He just kind of broke down because they were accusing him. He refers in this interview to his efforts to strike up a friendship with Vicky, Lanny's sister. Later, he was pressured by Victor Martinez and prosecutors Jay Rosenthal and Tom Moss. What do you recall about your conversations with Jay Rosenthal? He was asked. I just recall him and Victor talking to me about the case, and him and Victor basically leading me through what they wanted me to say. I had several conversations from the prison afterwards, and I think one before they took me down to Idaho Falls, telling me not to worry, that you will be safe, and I told them I didn't want anything for it. Rosenthal pulled some strings in having me shipped to Nevada. After I had originally talked to Victor and Moss, that's when I told them that I didn't want nothing for it and I wanted to get out of it, and they said no, he continued. If you back out now, he was told, we will prosecute you along with Lanny. This is the Chris Tapp maneuver, if you will. The attorney asked Swagger, and what did they say they would prosecute you for? Swagger replied, for knowing about it, and to be prosecuted for the same amount of time as Lanny, that if I didn't go through with it and not cooperating, and that I knew about this capital murder case and basically told me that if I didn't go through with it, I was through. I was young, he was 25 years old, and scared, and if I knew then what I know now, I would have said to find someone else and do what you need to do. At the time, he had been accused of sexually molesting a stepdaughter. Victor Martinez and the prosecutors were threatening to frame him for capital murder if he didn't perjure himself by testifying that Lanny Smith had confessed to the double murder that his brother almost certainly committed. What was your plan when you got out? He was asked near the end of the interview. I was going to try and contact Lanny to see what was going on, if it was still ongoing. I had never checked. I imagined there was some way to get a hold of Lanny at the prison and tell him that I wanted to clear things up. I was trying to make things better for myself and not considering someone else's life, Swagger told Lanny Smith's appellate attorney. To me, that is not good to my esteem or my integrity. This is all something I really tried to do for a long time, that is to say, making a clean breast of what he had done by way of perjuring himself, after being threatened and intimidated by Detective Rodriguez and the prosecutors. I can get on with my life, and hopefully Lanny can get back out there and have a life, instead of having a life he has been forced to live for no apparent reason. I know what it is like. When I did the sexual assault on my daughter and going to prison, so I know what it is like to be in a prison and having to live with that as a result of self-centeredness and selfishness. I cannot imagine Lanny and what he is going through, being convicted for something he never did. I really want my integrity all intact. I want some integrity in doing this. He has nothing to gain but a sense of self-respect for telling the truth and doing the right thing. Victor Rodriguez, Jared Furman, and their comrades, on the other hand, have everything to lose if somebody tells the truth. They have less character than a convicted and confessed child molester who is trying to do the right thing. What the screaming chartreuse hell has been going on in Bonneville County, Idaho? Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, doom spirito pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.